היי טקיז וברוכים הבאים לטקי טוקי, פודקאסט השיווק שיארח מדי תוכנית את אנשי השיווק הטובים ביותר לשיחה כלילה וזורמת של 30 דקות.
בפודקאסט נדבר על המהלכים היצירתיים ביותר במטרה לתת לחברות השראה להעז יותר וליצור אימפקט משמעותי. אז הרבה אנשים אמרו לנו ששכחנו בפעם הקודמת להציג את עצמנו ומי אתם בכלל שתעשו פודקאסט ולמה שנקשיב לכם.
שאלה טובה.
שאלה טובה. אז אירוניה וחלק מהבעיה שאנחנו שנינו מרקטירס שיודעים לשווק כמעט הכל חוץ מדבר אחד וזה את עצמנו. אז מצאנו פתרון יצירתי, כל אחד יציג את השני.
אז תכירו את כרמל, המייסד והמנכ"ל של חברת הטראו, חברת המיתוג והשיווק טכנולוגי המובילה בישראל, לדעתי, שמארחת אותנו בביתה הצהוב, אז תודה טראו.
ותכירו את אסף. יזם, לשעבר CMO של צ'קמרקס, CEO של קוין ממה, ובהווה CMO של פיירבולט, ומרקטיר בחסד עליון.
אפשר את זה בכתב?
לאימא.
לאימא. בוא נתחיל! ברוכים הבאים לעוד פרק של טקי טוקי, פודקאסט השיווק שמארח את מיטב המוחות של ישראל. אנחנו שמחים לארח פה את שמולי.
היי שמולי, הלו.
והפרק הזה עקב שפת האם של שמולי יהיה באנגלית, אז סליחה למאזיננו.
Sorry.
אבל נעבור לאנגלית. היי שמולי.
Hello. Hi, Shmuley. Thank you for having me. This is fun.
It's great having you here. And thanks for the effort. You just landed there, literally.
2 hours ago. Wow. 2 hours ago, got through customs. Thankfully, all easy.
We appreciate the gesture.
My pleasure.
I've known Shmuley for many years, and Carmel has the same experience.
And, way back.
I think we both Shmuley's the out of the box thinking, and I thought he's a perfect candidate for Techie Talkie, and. We'll just let you give a brief intro, of what you've been up to and all the great deeds. So go for
sure.
It.
So I'm Shmuley, as you said. I am currently the CMO of a brand new startup called Identic, based in North Tel Aviv. It's my first time in the fintech fraud prevention space, so it's a whole new industry, but a similar motivation and similar strategy to things I've done in the past. Previously, I was head of marketing at LawGeeks, ran their marketing department from zero to about 15 people over the space of about three and a half years. Before that, I built up the entire marketing team at Feedvisor, and way, way before that, I was the first marketing guy in at Clicktail and built the team there as well. So I've been in the really niche B2B SaaS technology Israeli marketing startup space for 12 years, thankfully 3 successful startups under my belt, and about a month ago moved to my fourth.
Very, very impressive.
Thank you.
So
what did you learn?
Wow, so much. I've learned a lot. We've discussed this once or twice. I have a very boring approach to marketing. Unlike the vast majority of people I meet in the space, who believe that 95% of marketing is creativity and ideology, and then you just do it and you move on to the next genius idea. I'm solely focused on the execution. I think the idea is 10%, but the other 90% is understanding that every marketing action, every exercise, every activity that you do essentially has an input, an activity, and an output. And this ranges from PPC, where you have input is audience plus dollars, activities, the ads that you run on the landing pages that you build, and your output is warm leads. And that's the easy understanding, but it's the same when you're doing PR, and I've had amazing success that we'll discuss, and some companies with creating a hell of a lot of noise, but still, that is the audience is the journalists, the activity is the PR activity that you're doing, and the output is getting hundreds of people to write about you. And when you follow that process, as boring as it sounds, you sometimes realize that people have been doing it wrong for so long because they don't understand what the input is, what the activity, and what the output is. Mm-hmm. Something which is always a bugbear of mine that I always kind of go to is conferences. Mm-hmm. If you spend $100,000 going to a conference, but you spend no time beforehand researching the audience, look at the competitors, or in my opinion, even worse, you know, the cardinal sin, you get back and you have this lead list and you don't do anything with it for weeks, months, you just add it to a database somewhere, you've missed the input, the activity, the output. Their input should be the money, the audience, whatever you're trying to, whatever is there in the conference itself. The activity is a kick-ass conference, but the activity also includes campaigns beforehand, campaigns during, social campaigns, targeting people who you know you're going to be there, the follow-up, you know, the outbound cadences that go out beforehand and the inbound cadences that go afterwards. And that's the difference between doing a conference and generating a bucket of hot leads.
Yeah.
And for me, that path, that what I call the boring side, the execution, takes a lot of creativity and it takes a lot of understanding of all the moving parts.
Yeah.
So that generally is my boring approach to marketing. But there's a lot of very creative things that you can do along the way, as I said.
All right. So give us one.
Do share, please.
Do share.
So there's a few things that I've done in the past which I think I was astonished myself at how successful they were. We'll go in chronological order, but there's two or three that really stand out. The first one is about 8-7 years ago, when I started at FeedVisor. Amazon repricing was a...
So FeedVisor, for those of you, those who don't know.
So for those that don't know, number one, shame on you. Number two, it's a Amazon repricer, which essentially means we sold to people who sell on Amazon. As you know, largest marketplace, or second largest marketplace in the world, largest marketplace in the Western world.
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds of billions of dollars worth of sales are made the whole time. And it's primarily made by sellers. There are individuals that sell on Amazon. Mm-hmm. Amazon themselves sell 5-10% of the items, and what they want to do is expand and offer products to everyone else, but they let other people sell through Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're selling on Amazon, one of the biggest questions that everyone always has is, how do I set my prices? Am I too high? I'm not going to make any sales. If I'm too low, I'm not going to make any profit.
Yeah.
So any repricer essentially balances your profit versus sales to maximize, you know, your end results.
Yeah.
And back then, we were the very first people. We coined the phrase algorithmic repricing,
mm-hmm.
where everyone else was rule-based. And this leads me to something else that I always try and do, which is define a space and own it. Don't fall into other people's spaces, because then you're fighting them.
So define a category.
100%.
Yeah.
Define the category, and then your content and your communication strategy should be educating people about that category.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You happen to be the leader in that category. Maybe mm-hmm. you're the only one in that category because you've made it, but then you can push your agenda without pushing your company. To move on, one of the things that I noticed very early on, which is there was something called the Amazon Buy Box, which is that small box that says Buy Now, and you click it, and every time you click it, it makes a sale, and it gives it to one of the sellers on Amazon. Now, how it determines which seller on Amazon it goes to was and still is a highly kept secret. Amazon don't want you to know how it determines who wins this, because it's like Google. You'll just play the, you'll hit the right points and all of a sudden you'll make all the money.
I'm feeling lucky.
Exactly. And they want to avoid, the same way Google's SEO algorithm is one of the best kept secret in the world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we noticed, a lot of people were asking questions on the buy box. Not a lot of people knew a lot about it. So we went down the route of the best way to make yourself into an expert in anything is to tell people that you're an expert on that thing. And we started researching and learning about the buy box, and very soon we realized that we knew, I'm talking about a matter of weeks. We'd read every comment and every article, and we realized we knew more than anyone else on this field. So we made a big fuss about being the buy box experts. And we were announcing that we were going to launch the buy box. We were going to bust it open. And beforehand, we did something very clever. We reached out to journalists, we reached out to opinion leaders, bloggers, big, medium, and small, everyone who'd ever written about the buy box, and basically said, hey, we saw your post, you know, 3 months ago about the buy box. It was inspired. In fact, it's so good that it gave us, you know, an excuse to spend months researching that idea that you had and you wrote a comment about somewhere, and now we've actually written the manuscript of the buy box Bible. Two things. Number one, we'd like to credit you in the back. because you've given us so much. And second of all, we'd love it if you can read through this. And we sent this out to about 120, 130 different experts in the field. I think as a small startup that no one had heard of, we had three or four people replying. Those that replied were nice. They gave genuinely interesting comments. But the truth is, by that point, we'd already finished it, copywritten it. We were way into the design stage. And then a few weeks later, when we launched it, we emailed it, ungated, we emailed it as a PDF to every single one of those experts that we first asked for help with. First of all, we said, thank you so much. You've been overwhelmingly generous and have helped us so much. And we've really put together something which we could never have done without your specific genius. We've put your name at the back as a contributor, so you're welcome to tell people that you contributed to the Buy Box Bible. And we'd love it if you can share a link to our landing page, which is here. And we had something like 80, 85 of these experts in the field, all tweet, all shouted, all at the same day. We gave it to them all a couple of days early with an exclusive and said, we're not sharing this with anyone else, but you know, you wrote the thing. You contributed so much, we're launching it next week. And we had something like 6,000 downloads in the first 48 hours.
Now, when you say Bible, I'm just curious, you know, how long is this Bible?
So this was intentionally long. And we, in fact, we wrote it to be used as a reference guide. So we wrote it to be something that it was about 80 or 90 pages long. And each paragraph, was maybe two or three pages that copied this topic, was wholly inclusive. Which, by the way, made writing it a little bit easier because we could copy the same text throughout. So of original text, there wasn't quite as much. But the real amazing thing is when you go visiting customers and you see it printed next to their, you know, computer, that for us was kind of the gold standard. Then we knew that we had hit the point of being seen as the Bible Buy Box experts, the Buy Box Bible experts. So then when anyone ever spoke about repricing on any forums ever, there was always one guy, I'm not saying it wasn't us, but maybe it wasn't, who said, you know what, if you really want to know about repricing, these guys are the experts. Here's a link to their landing page.
That's amazing.
Wicked.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
I'm curious, you know, did you measure how those downloads translated into business?
Of course. I'm anal retentive when it comes to
that. Don't insult smoothly.
I have a...
No, because 6,000 downloads of a white paper is impressive.
Yeah.
Already, but obviously, you know, the metrics don't stop there.
The metrics didn't stop there. We had, if I'm not mistaken, I know I can open up old Salesforce.
It's been a while.
Buy this, but we had somewhere like 400 to 450 inbound leads from people that either read the white paper and then came to us specifically asking for help repricing, or that downloaded the white paper and then we ran an SDR outbound campaign in the first 60 days and responded. So we're talking about 450 maybe, you know, including those that don't turn up to demos, maybe 300 product demos with qualified customers, because obviously we qualify everyone before they're allowed to see anything. I very much believe that, again, talking about the execution side being, obviously the creative side is critical, but the execution being the part that makes it work, every single thing I've ever done has been tracked in Salesforce, built a campaign for it. And I spend an hour every morning boringly going through reports, making sure tracking's working, making sure that targeting's working properly, because you want to be in a stage 12 months down the line, 24 months down the line, when somebody says, should we do this again? And if you've ever done it before, then you can never get away with the answer of, I don't know. It's, you know, repetitiveness is one of the key elements of marketing. You do five things. Whatever works, you do again. Whatever doesn't, you know, make sure you've failed properly. This is something else that I always, always stress. If you're going to fail, fail well. You know, it bothers me when people say, listen, we have this event coming up. We don't know if we should do it or not. So we're thinking of just sending one person and, you know, doing it under budget. And my attitude is, if you're going to do it, make sure that you've put all the money and all the resources and all the effort into it to know that if it doesn't work, it wasn't because you didn't do it properly. Because if you're going to send one person and do it underdone...
It's a slippery slope. Because, you know, there's the approaches of go big or go home, or and there's the, you know, the flip side of just, you know, do as many as possible. And, you know, you're on a shoestring budget, so how do you, you know...
It's a very, very good question. I like... First of all, please fight me. You don't have to agree with what I'm going to say.
Of course.
My attitude is, you know, there's expression, throw things at the wall, and if it sticks, then you know it's good. I have two caveats to that. Number one, when you throw it, it has to reach the wall. Mm-hmm. If mm-hmm. you're going to spend $50 on Google AdWords and then tell me that Google AdWords doesn't work for your category or industry, it hasn't reached the wall.
Yeah.
And the second thing is, and this is sometimes for senior staff and for CEOs maybe a little bit harder, is once it's hit the wall and it sticks, go for it. Mm-hmm. When you are in a stage where you're doing trial and error and you want to see what works and you're testing 100 things, the most important thing is, you know, fail well, fail quickly. If it works, then you have to jump in and you have to really commit.
Yeah.
And often you'll find that when things aren't looking that good, when budgets are a little bit tight, people do too many things in a way because it's excusing them. Because then they can say, well, you know, we tried a whole bunch of things and it didn't work. But if something did work, then own it.
Yeah.
Go for it and double down.
Yeah. I guess each medium has its own like critical mass.
Yeah.
But so I know you like formulas. So if you can sum up like the entire Bible experience into like this formula, like identify, how do you identify this thing?
You want ideally to write about the thing that not enough people are writing about yet, so you can call yourself the expert in the field.
Yeah.
I would never write anything.
How do you get that?
So normally what the best way that I do it is in a new space, I'd start reading, researching, and find the things that people don't seem to know enough about but are interested in. I'll give you an example. At Law Geeks, you know, we wrote something called the Legal Tech Buyer's Guide, which was a very similar paper. It was 150 pages long, and it listed every single legal technology. By the way, all our competitors were there with their phone number and a link to their website.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we did this is because there were so many people online saying, I want to start using legal technology, I don't know what to buy. So when you see, after spending a week, 2 weeks, a month, kind of living in your industry, speaking to your customers, and seeing what the experts are saying and what they're not, you soon get a feeling of where the niche is that you can answer a question no one is. And by the way, with the Legal Tech Buyer's Guide, we did something similar, and we did it with our competitors. We said to all our competitors, all our competition, everyone, every legal technology in this space, we're going to list you in the new guide. Feel free to send us a description of yourself. We'll add it, and then we'll share it out. And obviously, when we shared it out, all of our competitors shared our guide because we list them all in top three of this space or top five of this space, which was incredibly useful. And it gave us the opportunity, as the guys that wrote the guide, to define our competitors exactly as we wanted to define them. So if we were, let's say, looking at enterprises and we had a very similar competitor, we would write, this is a great piece of software, great for checking contracts, for smaller companies, recently they've been moving into enterprise companies and wish them the best of luck. So you get to really nicely...
You position them.
Yeah. Exactly. And when you're positioning the market, I mean, one of the greatest things that came out of there is that Gartner themselves created a category that we defined for ourselves and we wrote in the buyer's guide. We told them where we wanted to be seen, and because nobody else was defining the categories and was defining the structure, Gartner said, oh, well, if Law Geeks have done this already, we'll take their definitions, we'll put them where they say they are.
That's amazing.
Which was very useful.
Let's talk a bit about defining a category. This is something that you've done in FeedVisor and also in Law Geeks.
Yeah. And it's something we did at Clicktel. We made up the term customer experience analytics.
Right.
When everyone else was web analytics, we moved towards customer experience analytics, which was then taken over by Adobe and a lot of other people who are, you know, it's now its own real field.
Mm-hmm.
Defining a category is something which, when done well, is one of the best and first tools, pieces of ammunition, that you have in your toolbox. Because when you define a category, three things happen simultaneously. The industry leaders, the guys that know everything, want to know who you are. Because there's a term, there's a buzzword, there's a keyword they haven't heard of before, and therefore they don't want to feel tripped up. They don't want somebody else to go to them and say, hey, have you heard of customer experience analytics? And they're like, I'm not sure. So when you offer to present to them, you get to do it. The second thing you get to do when you define a category, and this is very, very valuable is then you can take the role of the evangelist much easier.
Yes.
And you can spend a lot of time telling people why customer experience analytics is important. Mm-hmm. You don't have to tell people why they should use Clicktel. It's secondary.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
paint the picture of what customer experience should look like, how you get the analytics to match that, and what theoretical softwares you would need to match the two together. So it allows you to evangelize without sounding like you have an ego.
Like a sales pitch. Yeah.
Exactly. And the third thing, and this is also very, very valuable, is once you define the category, you get to define the market. So you say who is and who isn't. Mm-hmm. And it's something which we're working on now. I can't share too much about our current plans of world domination. But something which is very important is you have to, by saying who you are, and I learned this from the best, I think the people that did this best, which is MailChimp, mm-hmm. which is they say who they are by saying what they're not. So if, for example, MailChimp were fighting IBM, they would say, we're powerful, but not complicated. And therefore, without being negative, without throwing a spanner or shade at anyone, they're saying other people in the space are complicated. And obviously, that means the IBMs and the SAPs and the scary guys. They say, we're powerful, we're not complicated. We're friendly, but we're not to be underestimated. I'm not entirely sure how they worded it, but they get to hint as to how you should see everyone else.
Yeah.
Which again is very useful. So we did this at FeedVisor again by saying that we are algorithmic, we're not rule-based.
Yeah.
And then every other reprice said by definition was rule-based, and people went, wait one second, what's wrong with rule-based? And then we go, glad you asked, let me show you. And you get to define the them and us. And you can do it without being aggressive or without making it sound like a battle. You're just saying, this is them, this is us, these are the constraints that we're working with, and therefore, choose your path. You can go with a new technology or with the older, more complicated one.
Yeah, not friendly one.
Exactly, exactly that.
That's fascinating. So category definition is a whole topic, of its own right.
We can talk about
it for hours.
Yeah.
I recall a very interesting, campaign you guys did at LawGeeks with mm-hmm. AI versus lawyer, if yes. I recall correctly. So can you yes. share some details about that? Because I found that fascinating.
I'd be happy to. AI versus lawyer was, I think I can say, one of the highlights of my career, both in how much fun I had doing it and the outcomes at the end of the day, which blew myself and my entire team, the whole industry away. Essentially, what we did in AI Lawyer, the theory was, we were sitting in a board meeting, I think this was in Q3, and each team was presenting to the board, and the R&D guys stood up and said, actually, right now, our algorithms, as of this quarter, are more accurate than humans. And my marketing is shot mm-hmm. up, and we say, whoa, 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 really? And they're, yeah. Like, well, can we test this? Can we validate this? And they're like, sure, why not? From the R&D side, they weren't seeing this as a leap, but from my marketing point of view, this was the turning point that could be essentially another Google Go moment. That's what I was thinking. So we spent the next 6 months, and a lot of credit here has to go to a lot of the teams at LawGeeks that really invested. We invested quite a bit in doing this properly. Jonathan Marciano, who was our Director of Communications then, I think he had a baby halfway through the process, and I wasn't sure which one of the babies was his true baby. It was he put in so much effort, and a lot of credit goes to him and the rest of the team there. But we found online independent adjudicators, people that would actually help us put the test together. We found 20 fully qualified professional lawyers with experience reviewing contracts who were willing to go head to head with a machine. We found
that's courageous.
Yeah.
Well, isn't it?
Yes, but again, and this is the most important
thing.
They
thought they were gonna win.
Well, it's more than that. Yeah. And this is like my shining message throughout the whole process. And I'll get back to the process in a second. It's all about giving people the whiffum. What's in it for them. Mm-hmm. So for example, to the lawyers, we said, we're gonna make you a star. You're gonna be the people that fought the machine. If you win, you beat the machine. If you lost, you were at the precipice, you were at the pinnacle of the legal AI revolution, and when this goes global, your name's all over it. And I'm not saying lawyers have egos, but there's definitely those lawyers that like some publicity. And the same thing with the adjudicators. You know, we said to them, guys, we're going to give you the next thing. We're putting it in your lap. We went to 4 universities. We went to Stanford University and 3 others. I can't remember the names, but 4 big major universities. We initially, by the way, went to tens, but these were the 4 that said yes. I think Yale may have been one as well. And we basically said to them, we want to do this study. We want to do it properly. We don't want marketing fluff. We want to do a proper study. We're essentially giving it to you. We've found the lawyers. We've written the AI. We've found the adjudicator. We wrote the test. All we want you to do is check the tests, make sure it's clean. When the results come in, we'll send them to you. You can tell us that it's kosher. And then you can put your stamp on the paper. And every university wants to put papers out there. It's kind of what their WIFM is.
And they
want to be on the papers that get in the news because that's how they get grants. So, you know, we really did do the study properly. We got 20 lawyers. We got our AI here in Israel. We found 5 NDAs, which were made public after the Enron scandal. Mm-hmm. And we gave those 5 NDAs to the 20 lawyers. We gave those 5 NDAs to the AI. And they weren't contracts which were used at any time to train the AI. So it was a true test. Although obviously we went with a test that we were very, very confident we would win. We weren't asking them to negotiate. We weren't asking them to correct. It was just review the contract, highlight discrepancies, find these issues. That was it.
Yep.
So it was the most basic work. So we're not saying high-level stuff. And we put all the results together. We found out that the lawyers scored an average of 85% accuracy, which is good,
really good.
And we reminded them that in certain states to pass the bar, you need 60%. So nobody can doubt that question. And then the AI on the same contracts got 94% accuracy. Mm. And obviously, it took the lawyers an hour or two to do the test, and it took our software, all 5 contracts, 13 seconds. And we took this story huge. And at no point did we ever go to the journalists and say to them, end of lawyers, you know, the profession's coming to an end. But we fed them almost everything until that line. Then we waited for them to ask us, is this the end of the lawyers? Is this the end of them? We went, no, this is the beginning. This is like autopilots for planes, you know? There's no less pilots now than there are 100 years ago. In fact, there's more pilots.
Right.
But we sped the story up and we spun it as in, this is the next big AI landmark that we haven't been able to break. And we said there were AIs which were specifically dedicated to, you know, you had, what was the big blue, the chess?
Kasparov,
I think it was Blue Ocean, Blue something.
Deep Blue,
that's the one. You had Kasparov and Deep Blue back in, you know, the 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. Then you had Google AlphaGo, and now you have AI versus lawyer. And we fed it to them like that. Mm-hmm. And we were able to push this so hard. I think, quite honestly, we didn't sleep for 5 days until this came out. We pushed this to everyone. And we got 600 pieces of international major media coverage.
That's
talking, obviously, the VentureBeats and the TechCrunches all covered it. Mashable, there was their main piece, because initially we gave them the longest interview. They were on the dot on the day with a full article. That was picked up by Daily Mail in England, by Popular Mechanics, believe it or not. We had everyone from the New York Times to Washington Post. Last week, HBO, 100% true, you can find this on YouTube, did a documentary on Law Geeks and on the study that we did last year and put it on Vice News. And for me, each one of these things by themselves would have been worth the 5 months of effort. But when you combine them, I think that probably fed us enough interest that we could have turned off the marketing machine for 18 months after that.
Wow.
When I left 2 months ago, we were still getting leads daily because people read AI versus lawyer. And for me, the kind of the icing on the cake is Forbes did an article, you know, as these articles are often written, you know, the history of man versus machine, and they showed Kasparov and they showed Google Go, and they showed the first robot, and they did the first one that did the nails better than humans. Yeah. And then it was just like number 7, 8, or 9 was AI versus lawyer. Israeli startup law geeks, da da da. And it was like, that's it. Because then you're in the consciousness. Then you're in the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
Then
you had to just quit. Just
part
then.
Of the tapestry. Yeah, well, it's
drop,
not even...
I was mic drop.
Yeah. that, I kid you not, but the HBO article was filmed as I was leaving, and it came out just after I left, and that was like my mic drop moment. But
that's amazing. Yeah.
And it put us in the zeitgeist. And the interesting thing was, and this is 100% true, when I was first pitched the idea of AI versus lawyer, my initial reaction was... I don't know. It's risky.
Yeah,
it's risky.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's all in. Like,
from my experience, every time there's versus, like A versus B, people love versus. Yeah. People search for versus. You see that like on the Google complete.
Got this from Iris also.
And Iris
like versus.
Yeah, Iris does that, you know, as well. But there's many examples. So
people like versus.
That's a lot of investment.
It breaks down very complicated concepts into an apples to apples comparison. Mm-hmm. When I joined LawGeeks, and this is in no way criticism of the wonderful team at LawGeeks before I joined, but we didn't really know what we were. We hadn't even come up with, you know, the category of contract review automation yet. So we were document analysis, we were legal to the people, we were an amorphic AI solution. And right now, if you ask me what LawGeeks does, I can tell you one sentence. It's an artificial intelligence that can read and review contracts like a human. But if you ask me back then, when I joined, even a month or two in, we analyzed documents looking at structures of legal words within the system. It takes time.
Yeah.
You know, you have to
steal the story.
Yeah, and it's more than that. I actually believe that as a strategic marketer, you need to spend significant mental effort digesting. So once you've done your, be it a week, be it a month, be it 6 months, your research and your thinking, and you have everything together, you need to shut off, put on both wireless headphones, listen to music, even go on holiday for a week, do whatever you need to do, and then come back and off, and you get back and you think, you know what, this is the next thing that we're going to be doing. And to say, and to have marketers that sit there all day, every day, working hard, you know, I have absolutely nothing against that whatsoever, but there's a lot of value sometimes to stop running campaigns for a week,
take a step back,
writing content, whatever you're doing, take a step back. It costs. You're going to have a week where you haven't got a blog post, and if you're used to doing 3 blog posts a week, to turn off for a week is tough, but then you can come back at the end of it and say, okay, we have a new idea for a voice for our blog. We have a new idea for a campaign.
Yeah.
And it's something which I've learned from people around me saying to me, slow down, take a week. I know you know an answer now, but I don't want it now. Come back to me in a month with a better answer. And it's very valuable.
Those are the things that end up moving the needle and really, you know, make you rise above the noise. So so I think it's invaluable. Look, that's been awesome.
Yeah.
It's been super fast, but I think our time is over.
Wow.
any famous last words, you know, for the startup nation?
It's a hard one. There's a lot of things. I live my life as a marketer. There's two rules that I try and live by as much as possible. The first is don't be a dick. It's harder than you think to hold the basis. And the way that you calculate your dickishness is very simple.
Yeah.
Before you do something, think to yourself, would a dick do this? If they would, don't do it. It's that simple.
That's awesome advice.
And the second one is a little bit harder, but it's force people to argue with you. Don't be happy when people agree with you. Mm-hmm. Don't hire people that agree with you. Don't work with people that agree with you, because if all you're ever going to have is people agreeing with you, then at the end of the day, it's just you're a team of one.
Yeah.
It's you and everyone else is doing the same thing. So I always, as I said before, fight me. I always encourage people to argue with me, to challenge me. AI versus lawyer straight out would not have happened if it wasn't for my team saying to me, you're an idiot. If you believe in the technology, it's going to work. Make it happen. And then, to say what I said earlier, once we decided we were going with it, we dedicated 5 months and thousands of dollars of resources. It was worth every penny. I would argue that we had 100 times ROI on that piece of marketing, on that one piece of marketing.
Nice. Okay, so with that in mind, you know, we're forced to disagree.
Yeah. That's nonsense.
Thank you, Shmuley, and thank you, everyone.
אז תודה רבה לכל מי שהזין לנו עד לסוף הפרק. אנחנו מקווים שנהנתם, לפחות כמו שאנחנו נהננו. אם יש לכם פידבק כלשהו, whatsoever, תרגישו חופשי לשלוח לנו מייל talk@techitoki.io או פייסבוק או whatever.
ובמידה ואהבתם את הפרק, תפנקו אותו בחמישה כוכבים, תהיו חברים, באפליקציית הפודקאסטים החביבה עליכם, תכתבו ריוויו, והכי חשוב, sharing is caring, אז תעבירו אותו לכל מי שאתם חושבים שיכול להפיק ממנו ערך. אז עד הפעם הבאה,
סלמת כל טוב!